As it happens, there are big cultural differences in propensity to make this error. This fact offers the hope that people in more susceptible cultures may be able to overcome the error to some degree. The fundamental attribution error. Bill Gates is the richest person in the world. At the ripe old age of 19, Gates dropped out of Harvard to start Microsoft, and in a few short years, he made it the most profitable corporation in the world. It's tempting to think that he must be one of the smartest people who ever lived. Gates is undoubtedly extraordinarily bright. But what few people know about him is that his pre-college life was blessed, computationally speaking. He was bored at his Seattle public school in eighth grade in 1968, so his parents switched him to a private school that happened to have a terminal linked to a mainframe computer. Gates became one of a small number of people anywhere who had substantial time to explore a high-powered computer. His luck continued for the next 6 years. He was allowed to have free programming time in exchange for testing the software of a local company. He regularly sneaked out of his house at 3 a.m. to go to the University of Washington Computer Center to take advantage of machine time made available to the public at that hour. There was not likely another teenager in the world who had the kind of access to computers that Gates had. Behind many a successful person lies a string of lucky breaks that we have no inkling about. The Economist Smith has twice as many publications in refereed journals as The Economist Jones. We're naturally going to assume that Smith is more talented and hardworking than Jones. But as it happens, economists who get their PhDs in a fat year, when there are many university jobs available, do much better in the academic job market and have more successful careers than economists who get their PhDs in a lean year. The difference in success between Smith and Jones may have more to do with dumb luck than with smarts, but we're not going to see this. The careers of many college students who got their degrees during the Great Recession are going to be forever stunted. Unemployment is bad not just because it's demoralizing not to have a job, but because the repercussions may never cease. Parents are going to wonder where they went wrong with struggling Jane, who graduated from college in 2009, and what they did that was so different from how they brought up successful Joan, who graduated in 2004. Important influences can be hidden, but even when powerful situational determinants of behavior are staring us in the face, we can be oblivious to their impact. In a classic experiment from the 1960s, the social psychologists Edward Jones and Victor Harris showed people one of two essays about Cuba's political system, allegedly written by a college student in response to a requirement by a professor. One essay was favorable toward Cuba, and the other was unfavorable. The experimenters informed the participants who read the essay favorable to Cuba that it had been written as an assignment. An instructor in a political science course or in another experiment, a debate coach, required the student to write a pro-Cuba essay. The experimenters told other participants that the student who wrote the unfavorable essay had been required to write an anti-Cuba essay. I think we can agree that the participants had learned nothing about the student's actual attitudes toward Cuba. Yet the participants rated the first student as being substantially more favorable to Cuba than the second student. In everyday life, we ignore equally powerful influences on people's behavior. A professor friend of mine regularly teaches two different courses to undergraduates at Stanford. One is a statistics course, and the other is a community outreach course. The students who take his statistics course rate him at the end of the term as being rigid, humorless, and rather cold. The students who take the community outreach course rate him as flexible, funny, and quite warm. Whether you're heroic or heartless may depend on a contextual factor whose impact is far greater than we would tend to assume. The social psychologists John Darley and Bibb Latané conducted a series of experiments studying what has come to be known as bystander intervention. They contrived a number of situations that seemed like emergencies. An epileptic seizure, a bookcase falling on a person in an adjacent room, someone who fainted on the subway. The likelihood of a person offering help to the victim was hugely dependent on the presence of others. If people thought they were the only witness, they usually attempted to help. If there was another witness, actually a confederate of the experimenter, they were much less likely to help. If there were many witnesses, people were quite unlikely to offer help. In Darley and Latané's seizure experiment, in which people thought they were communicating over an intercom, 86% of people rushed to help the victim when they thought they were the only person who knew about the incident. If they thought there were two bystanders, 62% of people offered help. When four people presumably heard the cries for help, only 31% volunteered their services. To drive home the point that kindness and caring can be less important than situational factors, Darley and his colleague Daniel Batson conducted a study with theological students, people we might assume would be particularly likely to help someone in need. The researchers sent a number of Princeton theological students to a building across campus to deliver a sermon on the Good Samaritan, telling them the route to follow. Some of the students were told they had plenty of time to get to the building, and others were told they were already late. On their way to deliver the sermon, each of the seminarians passed a man who was sitting in a doorway, head down, groaning and coughing, and in obvious need of help. Almost two-thirds of the seminarians offered help to the man if they were in no rush. Only 10% offered help if they were late. Of course, if you knew only that a particular seminarian helped and another one didn't, you would have a much more favorable impression of the one who offered assistance than of the one who didn't. A circumstance like being in a rush wouldn't likely occur to you as a factor influencing the seminarian who failed to be a good Samaritan. And in fact, when you describe the experimental setup to people, they don't think that the situation, being late versus not, would have any effect at all on whether the seminarian would help or ignore the person in distress. Given this belief, they can only perceive failure to help as being due to poor character, something internal to the person. Hidden situational factors can also influence how smart a person seems to be. The social psychologist Lee Ross and his colleagues invited students to participate in a study with a TV quiz show format. One student, selected at random, was to ask the questions, and the other student was to answer them. The questioner's role was to generate 10 challenging but not impossible questions, and the contestant was supposed to provide answers out loud. Questioners took advantage of their role to display esoteric knowledge in the questions they posed. What is the sweet-smelling waxy stuff that comes from whales and is used as a base for perfume? Ambergris, in case you haven't recently read Moby Dick. Contestants managed to answer only a fraction of the questions. At the end of the session, both of the participants, as well as the observers, were required to rate both the questioners and the contestants' general knowledge. You might think it would have been clear to subjects and observers alike that the questioner's role gave him a big advantage. The role guaranteed that he would reveal no area of ignorance, whereas the contestant's role offered no opportunity for such selective, self-serving displays. But the role advantage of the questioner was not sufficiently obvious, either to the contestants or to the observers, to prevent them from judging the questioners to be unusually knowledgeable. Both the contestants and the observers rated the questioner as far more knowledgeable than either the contestant or the average student in the university. The quiz study has profound relevance to everyday life. The organizational psychologist Ronald Humphrey set up a laboratory microcosm of a business office. He told participants he was interested in how people work together in an office setting. A showily random procedure selected some of the participants to be managers and to assume supervisory responsibilities. Some were selected to be mere clerks who followed orders. Humphrey gave the managers time to study manuals describing their tasks. While they were studying them, the experimenters showed the clerks the mailboxes, filing system, and so on. The newly constructed office team then went about their business for 2 hours. The clerks were assigned to work on a variety of low-skilled, repetitive jobs and had little autonomy. The managers, as in a real office, performed reasonably high-skill-level tasks. The experimenters showed the clerks the mailboxes, filing system, and so on. The newly constructed office team then went about their business for 2 hours. The clerks were assigned to work on a variety of low-skilled, repetitive jobs and had little autonomy. The managers, as in a real office, performed reasonably high skill level tasks and directed the clerks' activities. At the end of the work period, managers and clerks rated themselves and each other on a variety of role-related traits. These included leadership, intelligence, motivation for hard work, assertiveness, and supportiveness. For all these traits, managers rated their fellow managers more highly than they rated their clerks. For all but hardworkingness, clerks rated their managers more highly than they rated their fellow clerks. People can find it hard to penetrate beyond appearances and recognize the extent to which social roles affect behavior, even when the random basis of role assignment and the prerogatives of particular roles are made abundantly clear. And of course, in everyday life, it's often less clear why people occupy the roles they do, so it can be very difficult to separate role demands and advantages from the intrinsic attributes of the occupant of the role. Only after I read about these experiments did I understand why I was typically so impressed with the astute questions my colleagues asked in the final oral examinations of PhD candidates, and usually somewhat disappointed by my students' less than trenchant answers. The fundamental attribution error gets us in trouble constantly. We trust people we ought not to. We avoid people who really are perfectly nice. We hire people who are not all that competent, all because we fail to recognize situational forces that may be operating on the person's behavior. We consequently assume that future behavior will reflect the dispositions we infer from present behavior. So that you won't think this generalization fails to square with the assertion that past behavior is the best guide to future behavior, note that it's past behavior over the long run, observed in many diverse situations, that is the excellent predictor, not behavior observed in only a few situations, especially a few situations all of the same type. Why do some kids sell drugs and other kids go to college? You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Jim Rohn, American entrepreneur and motivational speaker. When my son was 15 years old, I happened to be looking out my office window when I saw him walking across a parking lot with another boy. They were both smoking cigarettes, which was something my wife and I assumed that my son didn't do and wouldn't do. That evening, I said to my son, "I was disappointed to see you smoking a cigarette today." "Yes, I was smoking," he said defiantly, "but it wasn't because of peer pressure." Yes, it was. Or at any rate, he was smoking because a lot of his peers were smoking. We do things all the time because other people are doing them. They model behavior for us and often encourage us, openly or tacitly, to follow their example. They can be successful beyond our imagining. Social influence is perhaps the most researched topic in all social psychology. We can be blind to it not only when we're observing other people's behavior, but when we're trying to explain to ourselves the causes of our own behavior. The first social psychology experiment was conducted by Norman Triplett in 1898. He found that cyclists had much better times when they competed against another cyclist than when they merely competed against the clock. The general point has been made in scores of subsequent experiments. People perform more energetically not just when they're in competition with others, but even when other people are merely observing. The social facilitation effect on performance has even been found for dogs, possums, armadillos, frogs, and fish. You're probably wondering whether the effect is found for cockroaches as well. It is indeed. The social psychologist Robert Zients had cockroaches run for cover when he turned on a light. A cockroach ran faster if there was another cockroach next to it. The cockroaches ran faster even if other cockroaches were mere observers, watching from specially constructed cockroach bleachers. Many years ago, I bought a Saab automobile, and shortly thereafter started noticing that several of my colleagues were driving Saabs. Later, my wife and I started playing tennis, and were surprised that lots of my friends and acquaintances had taken up tennis as well. After a few years, we drifted away from tennis. I began to notice that the tennis courts I had frequented, instead of being lined up with people waiting their turn to play, were standing mostly empty. We took up cross-country skiing at about the same time that several of our friends did. That, too, we eventually lost interest in. I subsequently noticed that most of my skiing friends had also more or less dropped skiing. and I won't even bother to tell you about serving after-dinner drinks, minivans, going to obscure art films. I was quite unaware of what I can now see as the influence of our friends and neighbors on the behavior of my wife and me, but at the time, I would have said the favorable rating Consumer Reports gave to Saab was the main reason I bought one. My wife and I wanted to have regular exercise, and there was a tennis court across from our house, so that seemed the natural exercise to take up. There were always things to attribute our behavior to other than the influence of our acquaintances. We should choose our acquaintances carefully, because we're going to be highly influenced by them. This is especially true for young people. The younger you are, the more influenced you are by peers' attitudes and behaviors. One of a parent's most important and challenging roles is to make sure their children's acquaintances are likely to be good influences. The economists Michael Kramer and Dan Levy examined the grade point averages of students whose freshman roommate had been assigned to them at random. The investigators found out how much alcohol each student had tended to consume in high school. Students who had been assigned a roommate who came to college with a history of substantial drinking got grades a quarter point lower than students assigned a teetotaler. That can easily mean a GPA of B+ versus A- or C+ versus B-. If the student himself had been a drinker prior to going to college, that student got grades a full point lower if his roommate had been a drinker than if he had not. That can mean a good medical school for him versus no medical school. I used the word him deliberately. There was no effect on females of having a drinking roommate. It seems highly improbable that the unsuspecting student would have recognized that his roommate's drinking was the main cause of his disappointing scholastic achievement. Indeed, the investigators themselves don't know exactly why a roommate's behavior should be so important, though it seems likely that the drinking roommate just made drinking seem like a natural pastime. And of course, the more you drink, the less you study, and the less effective you are when you do study. You can reduce college students' drinking, incidentally, by simply telling them how much drinking goes on at their school. This tends to be substantially less than students think, and they move their drinking in line with that of their peers. I understand why President Obama wants you to go to college. He wants to remake you in his image, Senator Rick Santorum, during his 2012 presidential campaign. So was Senator Santorum right about what college does to people? Does it really push them toward President Obama's political camp? Indeed it does. The economist Amy Liu and her colleagues conducted a study of students at 148 different colleges and universities, large and small, public and private, religious and secular. They found that the number of students at the end of college who described themselves as liberal or far left in their politics increased by 32% over the number who described themselves as such when they were incoming freshmen. The number who described themselves as conservative or far right decreased by 28%. Students moved left on questions of marijuana legalization, same-sex marriage, abortion, abolition of the death penalty, and increasing taxes for the wealthy. If fewer people went to college, Republicans would win more elections. It's likely that you moved left in college, too. If so, does it seem to you that the liberalism of your professors was responsible, a desire to adopt the views of prestigious older students? I would bet not. It seemed to me that my own leftward drift in college was the consequence not of sponge-like absorption of professors' views or slavish imitation of my fellow students, but rather the result of coming independently to a better understanding of the nature of society and the kinds of things that improve it. But of course, my leftward drift was indeed the result in good part of social influence from students and professors. And those professors were influencing not just their students, but each other as well. A conservative student group has claimed that publicly available numbers from the Federal Election Commission showed that in 2012, 96% of Ivy League professors' political donations went to President Obama. They reported that precisely one professor at Brown University gave money to Mitt Romney. And it may have been sheer cussedness rather than political convictions that prompted the donation. Those political contribution trends may be exaggerated, but as a social psychologist and former Ivy League professor, I can assure you that those professors, A, are indeed overwhelmingly liberal, and B, don't recognize the conformity pressures influencing their own opinions. Left to themselves, you wouldn't find 96% of Ivy League professors reporting that they think daily toothbrushing is a good idea. Other institutions are also hothouses of liberalism. A Republican Party operative trying to recruit techies from Google discovered that people were much more likely to be out as gay than out as Republican. Needless to say, some communities are undoubtedly equally successful at fostering and enforcing conservatism. My candidates would include Bob Jones University and the Dallas Chamber of Commerce. And of course, the whole country isn't moving drastically to the left with each successive generation. Students from those liberal colleges are going to re-enter a world of people with a wide range of views, which will now begin to influence them in a more rightward direction on average. It's not just attitudes and ideology that are influenced by other people. Engage in a conversation with someone in which you deliberately change your bodily position from time to time. Fold your arms for a couple of minutes. Shift most of your weight to one side. Put one hand in a pocket. Watch what your conversation partner does after each change, and try not to giggle. Ideomotor mimicry is something we engage in quite unconsciously. When people don't do it, the encounter can become awkward and unsatisfying. But the participants won't know what it is that went wrong. Instead, she's kind of a cold fish. We don't share much in common. Awareness of social influence. The social psychologists George Goethals and Richard Reckman conducted the granddaddy of all studies showing the power of social influence, together with the blissful absence of any awareness of it. They asked white high school students their opinions about a large number of social issues, including one that was very salient and very controversial in their community at the time, namely busing for the purpose of racial integration. A couple of weeks later, the investigators called their participants and asked them to participate in a discussion of the busing issue. Each group comprised four participants. Three of the group's participants in a given group were like-minded. Either those members had all indicated they were pro-busing, or they had all indicated that they were anti-busing. The fourth person assigned to each group was a ringer, employed by the experimenters, armed with a number of persuasive arguments against the other group members' opinion. After the discussion, the participants filled out another questionnaire with a different format. One question asked their opinion on the busing issue. The original anti-busing students shifted their position substantially in a pro-busing direction. Most of the pro-busing students were actually converted to an anti-busing position. The investigators asked the participants to recall as best they could what their original opinions on the busing question had been. But first, the investigators reminded the participants that they were in possession of the original opinion scale and would check the accuracy of the participants' recall. Participants who had not been asked to participate in a discussion were able to recall their original opinions with high accuracy. But among the members of the discussion groups, the original anti-busing participants recalled their opinions as having been much more pro-busing than they actually were. The original pro-busing participants actually recalled their original opinions as having been, on average, anti-busing. As well as showing massive social influence and near total failure to recognize it, the Goethals and Reckman study also makes the disconcerting and important point that our attitudes about many things, including some very important ones, are not pulled out of a mental file drawer, but rather are constructed on the fly. Just as disconcerting, our beliefs about our past opinions are also often fabricated. I have a friend who told me in 2007 he would vote for any of the Republican candidates over the faddish and untried Obama. When I reminded him of this just before he enthusiastically voted for Obama in 2008, he was angry that I could have concocted such a story. I'm frequently told that a current strongly held opinion of mine conflicts with one I expressed in the past. When that happens, I can find it impossible to reconstruct the person, namely me, who could have expressed that opinion. Actor-observer differences in assessing the causes of behavior. A few years ago, a graduate student who was working with me told me something about himself that I would never have guessed. He had done prison time for murder. He hadn't pulled the trigger, but he had been present when an acquaintance committed the murder, and he was convicted of being an accessory to the crime. My student told me a remarkable thing about the murderers he met in prison. To a man, they attributed their homicides to the situation they had been in. "So I tell the guy behind the counter to give me everything in the register, and instead he reaches under the counter. Of course I had to plug him. I felt bad about it. There are obvious self-serving motives behind such attributions. But it's important to know that people generally think that their own behavior is largely a matter of responding sensibly to the situation they happen to be in, whether that behavior is admirable or abominable. We're much less likely to recognize the situational factors other people are responding to, and we're consequently much more likely to commit the fundamental attribution error when judging them, seeing dispositional factor as the main or sole explanation for the behavior. If you ask a young man why he dates the girl he does, he's likely to say something like, "She's a very warm person." If you ask that same young man why an acquaintance dates the girl he does, he's likely to say, "Because he needs to have a non-threatening girlfriend." When you ask people to say whether their behavior or their best friends usually reflects personality traits, or whether their behavior depends primarily on the situation, they'll tell you that their friend's behavior is more likely to be consistent across different situations than their own is. The main reason for the differences in the attributions actors and observers make is that the context is always salient for the actor. I need to know what the important aspects of my situation are in order to behave adaptively, though of course I'm going to miss or ignore many important things. But you don't have to pay such close attention to the situation that I confront. Instead, what's most salient to you is my behavior, and it's an easy jump from a characterization of my behavior, nice or nasty, to a characterization of my personality, kindly or cruel. You often can't see, or may ignore, important aspects of my situation. So there are a few constraints on your inclination to attribute my behavior to my personality. Culture context and the fundamental attribution error. People who grew up in Western culture tend to have considerable scope and autonomy in their lives. They can often pursue their interests while paying little attention to other people's concerns. People in many other cultures lead more constrained lives. The freedom of the West begins with the remarkable sense of personal agency of the ancient Greeks. In contrast, the equally ancient and advanced civilization of China placed much more emphasis on harmony with others than on freedom of individual action. In China, effective action always required smooth interaction with others, both superiors and peers. The differences between West and East in degree of independence versus interdependence remain today. In a book called The Geography of Thought, I propose that these different social orientations were economic in origin. Greek livelihoods were based on relatively solitary occupations such as trading, fishing, and animal husbandry, and on agricultural practices such as kitchen gardens and olive tree plantations. Chinese livelihoods were based on agricultural practices, especially rice cultivation, requiring much more cooperation. Autocracy, often benevolent, sometimes not, was perhaps an efficient way of running a society where every man for himself was not an option. So it was necessary for Chinese to pay attention to social context in a way that it wasn't for Greeks. The differences in attention have been demonstrated in a dozen different ways by experiments conducted with the Western inheritors of Greek independence and the Eastern inheritors of Confucian Chinese traditions. One of my favorite experiments, conducted by the social psychologist Takahiko Masuda, asks Japanese and American college students to rate the happy expression of the central figure in a cartoon. Japanese students rate the central figure as less happy when he's surrounded by sad figures or angry figures than when he's surrounded by happier figures. The Americans were much less affected by the emotion of the surrounding figures. The experiment was also carried out with sad or angry figures in the center and with happy, sad, or angry faces in the background with similar results. The attention to context carries through to physical context. To see how deep this difference in attention to context goes, imagine a still from a 20-second color video of an underwater scene. Masuda and I have shown such videos to scores of people and then asked them to tell us what they saw. Americans are likely to start off by saying, "I saw three big fish swimming off to the left. They had pink fins and white bellies and vertical stripes on their backs." Japanese are much more likely to say, "I saw what looked like a stream. The water was green. There were rocks and shells on the bottom. There were three big fish swimming off to the left." Only after the context was established did the Japanese zoom in on what are the most salient objects for Americans. Altogether, the Japanese reported seeing 60% more background objects than did the Americans. That's what you'd expect, given that East Asians pay more attention to context than do Westerners. The differential attention to context results in Easterners having a preference for situational explanations for behavior that Westerners are more likely to explain in dispositional terms. A study by Korean social psychologists found that if you tell someone that a particular person behaved as did most people in the person's situation, Koreans infer, quite reasonably, that something about the situation was the primary factor motivating the person's behavior. But Americans will explain the person's behavior in terms of the person's dispositions, ignoring the fact that others behaved in the same way in the situation. Easterners are susceptible to the fundamental attribution error, just not as susceptible as Westerners. For example, in a study similar to the one by Jones and Harris, demonstrating that people tend to assume an essay writer holds the opinion required by the assignment, Inchul Choi and his co-workers showed that Korean participants made the same mistake as Americans. But when participants were put through the same kind of coercive situation as those whose essays they were about to read, the Koreans got the point and didn't assume that the writer's real attitudes corresponded to their essay position. Americans, however, learned nothing from having the situation made so obvious and assumed they had learned something about the essay writer's opinion. Easterners tend to have a holistic perspective on the world. They see objects, including people, in their contexts. They're inclined to attribute behavior to situational factors, and they attend closely to relationships between people and between objects. Westerners have a more analytic perspective. They attend to the object, notice its attributes, categorize the object on the basis of those attributes, and think about the object in terms of the rules that they assume apply to objects of that particular category. Both perspectives have their place. I have no doubt that the analytic perspective has played a role in Western dominance in science. Science is at base a matter of categorization and discovering the rules that apply to the categories. And in fact, the Greeks invented science at a time when Chinese civilization, though making great progress in mathematics and many other fields, had no real tradition of science in the modern sense. But the holistic perspective saves Easterners from some serious errors in understanding why other people behave as they do. Moreover, the reluctance to make dispositional attributions contributes to Eastern belief in the capacity of people to change. As we'll see in Chapter 14 on dialectical reasoning, the assumption of malleability of human behavior helps Asians to be correct about important questions that the Western perspective gets wrong. Summing up, one of the main lessons of these first two chapters is that there is vastly more going on in our heads than we realize. The implications of this research for everyday life are profound. Pay more attention to context. This will improve the odds that you'll correctly identify situational factors that are influencing your behavior and that of others. In particular, attention to context increases the likelihood that you'll recognize social influences that may be operating. Reflection may not show you much about the social influences on your own thinking or behavior, but if you can see what social influences might be doing to others, it's a safe bet you might be susceptible as well. Realize that situational factors usually influence your behavior and that of others more than they seem to, whereas dispositional factors are usually less influential than they seem. Don't assume that a given person's behavior in one or two situations is necessarily predictive of future behavior. And don't assume that the person has a trait or belief or preference that has produced the behavior. Realize that other people think their behavior is more responsive to situational factors than you're inclined to think, and they're more likely to be right than you are. They almost certainly know their current situation and their relevant personal history better than you do. Recognize that people can change. Since the time of the ancient Greeks, Westerners have believed that the world is largely static, and that objects, including people, behave as they do because of their unalterable dispositions. East Asians have always thought that change is the only constant. Change the environment and you change the person. Later chapters argued that a belief in mutability is generally both more correct and more useful than a belief in stasis. These injunctions can become part of the mental equipment you use to understand the world. Each application of the principles makes further applications more likely because you'll be able to see their utility and because the range of situations in which they can be applied will consequently increase. Chapter 3. The Rational Unconscious. We generally feel that we're fairly knowledgeable about what's going on in our heads, what it is we're thinking about, and what thinking processes are going on. But an absolute gulf separates this belief from reality. As should be clear from the two chapters you've just heard, a huge amount of what influences our judgments and our behavior operates under cover of darkness. Stimuli we hardly take conscious note of, if we pay attention to them at all, can have marked effects on our behavior. Many of the stimuli that we do notice have consequences far beyond what seems plausible. We don't know that we walk more slowly when we're thinking about elderly people. We don't know that we rated Jennifer's performance more highly than Jasmine's, in part because we know that Jennifer has higher social class origins than Jasmine. We don't realize that, contrary to our usual voting behavior, we endorsed higher tax rates for education in our community, in part because the vote took place in a school in this election. We don't realize that we signed Bob's petition but not Bill's, in part because of the clearer font in Bob's petition. We don't realize that we found Marion to be a warmer person than Martha, in part because we shared coffee with Marion and iced tea with Martha. Although it feels as if we have access to the workings of our minds, for the most part we don't. But we're quite agile in coming up with explanations for our judgments and behavior that bear little or no resemblance to the correct explanations. These facts about awareness and consciousness are laden with important implications for how we conduct our daily lives. Consciousness and confabulation. Many years ago, Timothy Wilson and I began a program to find out how people explain to themselves cognitive processes that influence their judgments in ordinary, everyday situations. We expected to find that when people lack a theory about what's going on in their heads or hold to a wrong theory, they can misidentify what really was happening. And they do this because they have no window on cognitive processes, just theories about what those processes might be. In one simple study, we had people memorize word pairs. Then we asked them to participate in a word association study. For example, one of the word pairs in the first study was ocean, moon. In the word association task in the second study, we asked them to name a detergent. You probably won't be surprised to know that having memorized that particular word pair made it more likely that the detergent named would be Tide. Some participants, of course, were not exposed to the ocean-moon pair so that we would have a base for comparison. After the word association task was over, we asked participants why they came up with the word that they did. They almost never mentioned the word pair they had learned. Instead, participants focused on some distinctive feature of the target. Tide is the best-known detergent. Some personal meaning of it. My mother uses Tide. Or an emotional reaction to it. I like the Tide box. When specifically asked about any possible effect of the word cues, approximately a third of the subjects did say that some of the words had probably had an effect. But there is no reason to assume that those participants were actually aware of the link. For some of the influential word pairs, not a single participant thought they had an effect on their associations. For other pairs, many participants claimed there had been an influence of the word pairs, whereas in fact only very few had been influenced. We know this because we know the extent to which learning the word pairs actually affected the probability of coming up with the target word. This study establishes that not only can people fail to be aware of a process that went on in their heads, they can fail to retrieve that process when asked directly about it. People can fail not merely to identify that some factor A influenced some outcome B. They may actually believe that it was outcome B that influenced factor A. In some of our studies, participants' reports about the reasons for their judgments actually reversed the real causal direction. For example, we showed students an interview with a college teacher who spoke with a European accent. For half the participants, the teacher presented himself as a warm, agreeable, and enthusiastic person. The other half of the participants saw the teacher present himself as a cold, autocratic martinet who was distrustful of his students. Participants then rated the teacher's likability and also three attributes that were by their nature essentially invariant across the two experimental conditions: his physical appearance, his mannerisms, and his accent. Students who saw the warm teacher, of course, liked him much better than participants who saw the cold version of the teacher, and the students' ratings of his attributes showed they were subject to a very marked halo effect. A halo effect occurs when knowing something very good about a person, or very bad, colors all kinds of judgments about the person. The great majority of the participants who saw the warm version rated the teacher's appearance and mannerisms as attractive, and most were neutral about his accent. The great majority of the participants who saw the cold version rated all these qualities as unpleasant and irritating. Were the participants who saw the friendly version of the teacher aware that their positive feelings for him had influenced their ratings of his attributes? And were those who saw the cold version aware that their negative feelings had influenced their ratings of his attributes? We asked this question of some of the participants. They strongly denied any effect of their positive or negative feelings for the teacher on their ratings of his attributes. In effect, give me a break. Of course I can make a judgment about someone's accent without being influenced by how much I like him. We asked other participants the reverse question. How much did their feelings about the teacher's attributes influence their overall liking for him? Participants who saw the warm version denied that their feelings about the teacher's attributes influenced their overall evaluation of him. But participants who saw the cold version felt that their dislike of each of the three attributes had probably contributed to their dislike of him. So these participants got things exactly backward. Their dislike of the teacher had lowered their evaluation of his appearance, his mannerisms, and his accent, but they denied such an influence and maintained instead that their dislike of these attributes had decreased their overall liking of him. So we can be confident that we have not been influenced by something that did in fact influence us, and we can be equally confident that something that did not influence us did have an effect. This degree of confusion can wreak havoc on our decisions about people. We don't always know why we like them or dislike them, and therefore can make serious mistakes in dealing with them, trying, for example, to get them to change attributes and behavior that we think are making us dislike them, but that are in fact neutral and have nothing to do with our overall feelings about them. Subliminal perception and subliminal persuasion. People needn't be aware of a stimulus at all in order for it to affect them. The term subliminal is used to refer to a stimulus that a person is not consciously aware of. A lyman is the point at which a stimulus such as a light, noise, or occurrence of any kind becomes detectable. A famous finding in psychology is the discovery that the more times people are exposed to a stimulus of a given type, ditties, Chinese characters, Turkish words, people's faces, the more people like the stimulus, so long as they don't dislike the stimulus to begin with. This so-called mere familiarity effect is shown by a study in which people listened to a communication played for one ear while having various tone sequences piped into the other ear. It turns out that the more frequently people hear a given tone sequence, the more they like it. And this is true even when people have no awareness that the tones were played for them and no ability after the experiment is over even to distinguish tone sequences that had been played for them many times from those they had never heard. The psychologists John Barge and Paula Pietramonaco presented words on a computer screen for 1/10 of a second, and then to make sure the participants were unaware of what they had seen, they presented a masking stimulus consisting of a line of X's where the word had been. Some participants were exposed to words with a hostile meaning and some to neutral words. The participants then read about Donald, whose behavior could be construed either as hostile or as merely neutral. A salesman knocked at the door, but Donald refused to let him enter. Participants exposed to the hostility-related words rated Donald as being more hostile than did participants exposed to the neutral words. Immediately after reading the paragraph, participants couldn't distinguish words they had seen from those they hadn't, and didn't even know that words had been flashed at all. Findings such as these raise a question as to whether there is such a thing as subliminal persuasion, being influenced to believe something or do something in response to a stimulus presented at such a low intensity that people can't report whether they have seen anything. There's been quite a bit of research on this topic over the years, but very little of it was well enough conducted to be convincing one way or the other. some recent marketing research indicates that subliminal stimuli can in fact influence product choice. For example, if you make people thirsty and then expose them to a particular brand name presented so briefly that they're unaware of it, they're more likely to choose that brand when given a choice between it and a brand that wasn't presented. But there's no question that stimuli that are supraliminal, above the level of awareness, but seemingly incidental and little noticed, can have an effect on consumer choices. Even so trivial a stimulus as the color of the pen someone uses to indicate product choice can be influential. People writing with an orange pen choose more orange products in a consumer survey than people writing with a green pen. Contextual cues matter for consumer choice as for everything else. How to perceive before perceiving. In the popular mind, the unconscious is primarily the repository of repressed thoughts about violence and sex and other things best unmentioned. In fact, however, the conscious pod has no right to call the unconscious kettle black. There's plenty of sex and violence roaming around in the conscious mind. If you give a buzzer to college students and have them write down what they were thinking about each time the buzzer goes off, much of the time it's a sexual thought. And the great majority of college students report that they've entertained thoughts of killing someone. Rather than just mucking about with unacceptable thoughts, the unconscious mind is constantly doing things that are useful, even indispensable. The unconscious mind pre-perceives for us. Think of our perceptual systems as monitoring unconsciously a vast array of stimuli. The conscious mind is aware of only a small fraction of what's in that array. The unconscious mind forwards to the conscious mind those stimuli that will interest you or that you need to deal with. If you doubt this claim, think of the situation of being in a room with a grandfather clock. You've been listening to its ticking, whether you know it or not. How can we be sure of that? Because if the clock stops ticking, you instantly notice that. Or consider the cocktail party phenomenon. You're standing in a room with 30 other people, straining to hear the person you're talking to over the hubbub. You're hearing nothing but what she is saying. But no, actually, you've been hearing a lot else besides. If someone 5 feet away from you mentions your name, you instantly pick that up and orient toward the speaker. Just as the unconscious mind has a much larger perceptual capacity than the conscious mind, it has a far greater ability to hold multiple elements in thought and a far greater range of kinds of elements that can be held in thought. A consequence of this is that the conscious mind can mess up your evaluation of things if you let it get into the act. If you're encouraged to verbally express your reactions to objects such as art posters or jams and tell what you like and dislike about each one, your choices are likely to be worse than if you simply think about the objects for a while and then make a choice. We know the judgments are worse because people asked to verbalize their thought processes report being less satisfied with the object they chose when they're asked to rate it at some later point. Part of the reason conscious consideration of choices can lead us astray is that it tends to focus exclusively on features that can be verbally described. And typically, those are only some of the most important features of objects. The unconscious considers what can't be verbalized as well as what can, and as a result makes better choices. If you cut the conscious mind out of the process of choosing, you can sometimes get better results. In a study supporting this conclusion, Dutch investigators asked students to pick the best of 4 apartments. Each apartment had some attractive features, very nice area of town, and some unattractive features, unfriendly landlord. One apartment was objectively superior to the others because it had 8 positive, 4 negative, and 3 neutral features, a better mix than the others. Some participants had to make their choice immediately, with little time to think about the choice either consciously or non-consciously. Other participants were asked to think carefully about their choice for 3 minutes and review all the information as best they could. These participants had plenty of time for conscious consideration of the choice. A third group saw the same information as the others, but participants weren't able to process it consciously because they had to work on a very difficult task for the 3-minute period. If they were processing the information about the apartments, they were doing so without awareness. Remarkably, participants in this last distracted group working on the difficult task were almost a third more likely to pick the right apartment than the group allowed plenty of time for conscious thought. Moreover, the latter group failed to make better choices than the group given scarcely any time to think. These findings obviously have profound relevance for how we should make choices and decisions in life. We'll have occasion to be reminded of this in the next part of the book, where we discuss theories of how people make choices and how they can maximize the likelihood that those choices will be the best possible. Learning. The unconscious mind can actually be superior to the conscious mind in learning highly complex patterns. More than that, in fact, it can learn things that the conscious mind can't. Pavel Levitsky and his co-workers asked people to pay attention to a computer screen divided into four quadrants. An X would appear in one of the quadrants. The participants' task was to press a button predicting which quadrant the X was going to appear in. Though participants didn't know it, whether an X appeared in a given quadrant was dictated by a very complicated set of rules. For example, an X never appeared twice in a row in the same quadrant, and X never returned to its original location until it had appeared in at least two of the other quadrants. An X in the second location determined the location of the third, and the fourth location was determined by the location on the previous two trials. Could people learn such a complicated rule system? Yes. We know people can learn them because, one, participants became faster over time at pressing the correct button, and two, when the rules suddenly changed, their performance deteriorated badly. But the conscious mind was not let in on what was happening. Participants didn't even consciously recognize that there was a pattern, let alone know exactly what it was. Participants were adept, however, at accounting for suddenly worsened performance. That may have been especially true because the participants were psychology professors, who incidentally knew they were in a study on non-conscious learning. Three of the professors said they had just lost the rhythm. Two accused the experimenter of putting distracting subliminal messages on the screen. Why don't we recognize consciously just what pattern it is that we've learned? I'll ask the curt question, why should we? For most purposes, what's crucial is that we learn a pattern, not that we be able to articulate exactly what the rules behind the pattern are. The unconscious mind is very good at detecting all kinds of patterns. Imagine a computer grid with 1,000 pixels that can be either black or white. Take half of that grid and randomly make some proportion of the pixels black and some white. Then flip the half grid over and create the mirror image of the original. Place the two images side by side. You will instantly see the symmetry between the two halves. How is it that you see there is perfect symmetry? It's certainly not by conscious calculation, determining whether each pixel in the mirror image location is the same or not. The number of calculations necessary to determine whether there is perfect symmetry is 500,000. That computational trick couldn't be performed quickly even by computers until relatively recently. Laborious calculation is clearly not involved in complex pattern detection. Seeing a mirror image is instantaneous and automatic. If it's there, you can't not see it. And if someone were to ask you what the pattern of pixels was exactly, you would be utterly stumped, unless by some miracle the pixels form themselves into a few clear and readily describable shapes. Your nervous system is an exquisitely designed pattern detector, but the process by which it sees patterns is completely opaque to us. Unfortunately, we're a little too good at detecting patterns. We see them even when they aren't there. As we'll see in Part 3, we're often confident that a collection of events that are utterly random have been caused by some agent such as another person. Problem solving. Prime numbers are those that are divisible only by one and themselves. Euclid proved more than 2,000 years ago that there are an infinite number of prime numbers. An interesting fact about prime numbers is that they often appear as twins, differing only by two, such as 3 and 5, 17 and 19. Are there an infinite number of twin primes? This problem has fascinated eminent mathematicians and amateurs alike, but no solution appeared for the past two millennia and more. Computers have discovered twin pairs as large as 3,756,801,695,685 times 2 to the 666,689th minus 1. But brute computing power could never establish the truth of the conjecture, and a solution to the twin prime problem has long been a mathematical holy grail. On April 17, 2012, the Annals of Mathematics received a paper from an obscure mathematician at the University of New Hampshire that claimed a giant leap toward verifying the twin primes conjecture. The author was 50-something Yitong Zhang, who had spent many years adrift in jobs such as accountant and even subway employee before he finally got a job at UNH. Mathematics journals are constantly fielding grandiose claims from obscure mathematicians. But the editors at the Annals found Zhang's arguments plausible on the surface and promptly sent the paper out for review. 3 weeks after receipt of the paper by the Annals, warp speed by academic standards, all the referees pronounced the claims valid. What Zhang proved was that there are infinitely many pairs of prime numbers that differ by 70 million or less. No matter how far you go into the region of spectacularly large prime numbers, and no matter how infrequent they become, you will keep finding prime pairs that differ by less than 70 million. Number theorists pronounce the result astounding. At the invitation of Harvard University, Zhang gave a lecture on his work to a huge crowd of Cambridge academics. His talk impressed his hearers as much as the paper had wowed reviewers. Zhang had worked on the twin prime conjecture for 3 years, making no progress whatsoever. Then the solution suddenly came to him, not while he was toiling away on the problem in his office, but while he was sitting in a friend's backyard in Colorado while he waited to leave for a concert. "I immediately knew that it would work," he said. Now that the unconscious had done its part, the hard conscious work began. It took Zhang several months to work out all the details of the solution. Zhang's experience is quite typical of creative problem solving at the very highest level. There is a striking uniformity in the way creative people, artists, writers, mathematicians, and scientists, speak about how they created their products. The American poet Brewster Geeslin collected into one volume a number of essays on the creative process by a variety of highly inventive people from Poincaré to Picasso. "Production by a process of purely conscious calculation seems never to occur," Geeslin says. Instead, his essayists describe themselves almost as bystanders, differing from observers only in that they are the first to witness the fruits of a problem-solving process that's hidden from conscious view. Geeslin's essayists insist that A, they had little or no idea what factors prompted the solution, and B, even the fact that thought of any kind about the problem was taking place is sometimes unknown. The mathematician Jacques Adhémar reports that on being very abruptly awakened by an external noise, a solution long searched for appeared to me at once without the slightest instant of reflection on my part, and in a quite different direction from any of those which I previously tried to follow. The mathematician Henri Poincaré records that the changes of travel made me forget my mathematical work. At the moment when I put my foot on the step of the omnibus, the idea came to me. Without anything in my former thoughts seeming to have paved the way for it, that the transformations I had used to define the Fuchsian functions were identical with those of non-Euclidean geometry. The philosopher and mathematician Alfred North Whitehead wrote of the state of imaginative muddled suspense which precedes successful inductive generalization. The poet Stephen Spender describes a dim cloud of an idea which I feel must be condensed into a shower of words. The poet Amy Lowell wrote, "An idea will come into my head for no apparent reason. The bronze horses, for instance. I registered the horses as a good subject for a poem, and having so registered them, I consciously thought no more about the matter. But what I had really done was to drop my subject into the subconscious, much as one drops a letter into the mailbox. 6 months later, the words of the poem began to come into my head. The poem, to use my private vocabulary, was there." What's true for the most creative people in history working on the most interesting ideas is true for you and me, working on much more mundane problems. The better part of a century ago, the psychologist N.R.F. Meyer showed people two cords hanging from the ceiling of a laboratory strewn with many objects such as clamps, pliers, and extension cords. Meyer told the participants that their task was to tie the two ends of the cords together. The difficulty was that the cords were placed far enough apart that the participants couldn't reach one while holding onto the other. Meyer's participants quickly came up with several of the solutions, for example, tying an extension cord to one of the ceiling cords. After each solution, Meyer told the participants, "Now do it a different way." One of the solutions was much more difficult than the others, and most participants couldn't discover it on their own. While the participants stood perplexed, Meyer would be wandering around the room. After the participant had been stumped for several minutes, Meyer would casually put one of the cords in motion. Then, typically within 45 seconds of this clue, the subject picked up a weight, tied it to the end of one of the cords, set it swinging like a pendulum, ran to the other cord, grabbed it, and waited for the first cord to swing close enough that it could be seized. Meyer immediately asked the participants to tell how they thought of the idea of a pendulum. This question elicited such answers as, "It just dawned on me. It was the only thing left. I just realized the cord would swing if I fastened a weight to it." A psychology professor participant gave a particularly rich account. "Having exhausted everything else, the next thing was to swing it. I thought of the situation of swinging across a river. I had imagery of monkeys swinging from trees. This imagery appeared simultaneously with the solution. The idea appeared complete." After hearing their explanations, Meyer grilled his participants about whether the swinging cord had had any effect on them. Almost a third allowed that it had. But there's no reason to believe that those participants were actually aware of the role of the cord. Rather, they might simply have found the theory plausible and endorsed it. To make sure that participants had no genuine introspective awareness of their thinking, Meyer conducted a new study in which he twirled a weight on a cord. This hint was useless. No one solved the problem after this cue was provided. For other participants, Meyer twirled the weight and then shortly afterward swung the cord. Most participants then promptly applied the pendulum solution. Upon being questioned, however, all of these participants insisted that the twirling weight had helped them to solve the problem and denied that swinging the cord had had any effect. The lessons of Meyer's experiment is profound. Problem-solving processes can be as inaccessible to consciousness as any other kind of cognitive process. Why do we have conscious minds anyway? The most important thing to know about the unconscious is that it's terrific at solving certain kinds of problems that the conscious mind handles poorly, if at all. But although the unconscious mind can compose a symphony and solve a mathematical problem that's been around for centuries, it can't multiply 173 by 19. Ask yourself to figure that out as you drift off to sleep and see if the product pops into your mind while you're brushing your teeth the next morning. It won't. So there's a class of rules, probably a very large class of even simple rules like those of multiplication, that the unconscious mind can't operate with. Yours and mine, that is. Savants can do it somehow. It seems paradoxical in the extreme that an operation any fourth grader can carry out consciously couldn't be handled by a von Neumann unconsciously. The unconscious mind operates according to rules, for sure, but we don't really have any good way as yet to characterize just which rule systems require consciousness and which can operate unconsciously, or whether there are any that can operate both ways. We do know that a given task can be carried out using either conscious rules or unconscious ones, but the solutions yielded by the one can be, and perhaps usually are, utterly different. Herbert Simon, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, computer scientist, psychologist, political scientist, attacked the contentions by Tim Wilson and me that there was no such thing as conscious observation of mental processes. He had found that people who were solving problems while thinking aloud could describe accurately the processes by which they solved them. But his examples only showed that people were capable of generating theories about what rules they were using to solve the problems, and that these theories were sometimes accurate. Not at all the same thing as observing the processes. In conscious problem solving, we're aware of 1. Certain thoughts and perceptions that are in our heads, 2. Particular rules that we believe govern or should govern how we deal with those thoughts and perceptions, and 3. Many of the cognitive and behavioral outputs of whatever mental processes are going on. I know the rules of multiplication. I know the numbers 173 and 19 are in my head. I know I must multiply 3 by 9, save the 7, and carry the 2, and so forth. I can check that what's available to my consciousness is consistent with the rules that I know to be appropriate. But none of this can be taken to mean that I am aware of the process by which multiplication is carried out. In conversation, Simon actually gave me the perfect example of how a given task can be carried out operating either by unconscious rules or by rules that are represented consciously. When people first play chess, they move the pieces around without being able to tell you what rules, if any, they're following. But they are indeed following rules. Their technique is called Duffer strategy, whose rules are well known to experts. Later, if people stick with chess for a while, read books on it, and talk to highly competent players, they play according to rules that are quite conscious and that they can describe accurately. But I would insist they can't see what's going on. They can simply check that their behavior is consonant with the consciously represented rules and with the thoughts they have while using those rules. It's unfortunate that we can't monitor the processes that underlie the solutions to complex problems. But it's even more unfortunate that we often are convinced that we can. It can be hard to change someone's mind about the wisdom of some strategy or tactic when the person is dead certain that he knows just what's going on and he's not making the mistake you're trying to point out to him. When players become genuinely expert, they once again can no longer accurately describe the rules they're using. This is partly because they no longer have conscious representation of many of the rules they learned as an intermediate player, and partly because they have induced unconsciously the strategies that make them masters or grandmasters. The assertion that we have no access to the processes that underlie our judgments may not seem so radical in light of two considerations. One, we claim to know the processes that underlie judgment and behavior, but we make no claim that we have awareness of the processes underlying perception or retrieval of information from memory. We know the latter processes are completely beyond our ken. Perfectly adequate processes producing perception and memory take place without our awareness. Why should cognitive processes be any different? 2. From an evolutionary standpoint, why would it be important to have access to the mental processes that are doing the work for us? The conscious mind has enough to do without also having to be aware of mental processes that are producing the needed inferences and behavior. To say that there's no direct awareness of mental processes is not to say that we're usually wrong about what goes on behind the scenes. Often, maybe usually, I can say with justified confidence what were the most important stimuli I was attending to and why I behaved as I did. I know that I swerved the car to avoid hitting the squirrel. I know that the main reason I gave at the office was because everyone else was making a donation. I know that I was anxious about the exam because I hadn't studied very much. But in order to be right about what drives my judgments and behavior, I have to have a correct theory. I have no theory that says I'm less likely to cheat if there's a picture of a coconut hanging over the honest box, or that voting in a church has made me more likely to vote against abortion, or that hunger is making me unsympathetic to a job applicant, or that fishy smells make me doubt what I'm reading, or that holding a hot coffee cup makes me think you're a warm person. Indeed, what would a theory of such things look like? Anything less general and less useless than who knows what all is going on to affect my behavior? If we had theories about the processes underlying those behaviors, we would draw on them as reasons for behaving as we do. In many cases, in fact, we would resist those processes and often produce a better outcome. But lacking the correct theories about these kinds of processes, we can't have correct explanations for why we behave as we do. Summing up, this chapter has many implications for how we should function in daily life. Here are a few of the most important. Don't assume that you know why you think what you think or do what you do. We don't know what may have been the role played by little-noticed and promptly forgotten incidental factors. Moreover, we often can't even be sure of the role played by factors that are highly salient. Why should you give up belief in self-knowledge and do so at the cost of self-confidence? Because you're less likely to do something that's not in your best interest if you have a healthy skepticism about whether you know what you really think or why you really do the things you do. Don't assume that other people's accounts of their reasons or motives are any more likely to be right than are your accounts of your own reasons or motives. I frequently find myself telling other people why I did something. When I do that, I'm often acutely aware that I'm making this up as I go along, and that anything I say should be taken with more than a grain of salt. But my hearers usually nod and seem to believe everything I say. With psychologists, I usually have the grace to remind them there is no particular reason to believe me. Don't try that with non-psychologists. But despite my recognition that my explanations are somewhere between probably true and God only knows, I tend to swallow other people's explanations hook, line, and sinker. Sometimes I do realize that the person is fabricating plausible explanations rather than reporting accurately, but more typically, I'm as much taken in as other people are taken in by my explanations. I really can't tell you why I remain so gullible, but that doesn't prevent me from telling you to carry a salt shaker around with you. The injunction to doubt what people say about the causes of their judgments and behavior, incidentally, is spreading to the field of law. Increasingly, it's recognized that what witnesses, defendants, and jurors say about why they did what they did or reached the conclusions that they came to are not to be trusted, even when they are doing their level best to be perfectly honest. You have to help the unconscious help you. Mozart seems to have secreted music unbidden, and if you saw the movie Amadeus, you know that he frequently wrote down the output without ever blotting a note. But for ordinary mortals, creative problem solving seems to require consciousness at two junctures. 1. Consciousness seems to be essential for identifying the elements of a problem